Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The first half of this hour, the latest on the Orlando mass shooting earlier this week. Later, a historian will look at the important role that LGBT clubs have played in offering a safe haven, but tragically, there have been many attacks on these safe havens. We start the hour with Matt Sapotosky. He's a reporter at the Washington Post who covers the Justice Department. He has been doing extensive reporting from Orlando this week. Later, Lillian Faderman will join us. Lillian is an internationally known scholar of lesbian history and literature, author of several books. The latest is The Gay Revolution, The Story of the Struggle. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Matt, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Hey, thank you for having me.
I know the FBI has been looking at, I'm wondering if any progress has been made to determine why this killer targeted members of the LGBT community.
Yeah, they are looking at that. And I don't know that they have said specifically why, but you've probably seen some of our reporting in the Washington Post suggesting that there were people who said he himself was on some dating apps meant for the gay community.
Mm-hmm.
That maybe one theory would be that there was something going on there. He also espoused some very sort of hateful Islamic State ideals, so maybe that could play into the motivation. But it's a little bit of a jumble right now. We don't know if one of those is true or maybe both is true.
Mm-hmm. If indeed he was homophobic, and if indeed, I know the idea has been explored that he indeed may have been gay, and so he was hating himself for that and then lashed out at others.
Yeah, maybe there was some issue of repression or something like that.
Did you get any news today? I was watching some of the press conference that took place in Orlando. Was there anything new today?
You know, it was pretty sparse on new substantive detail. They really walked back the idea that there were any kind of imminent charges against the wife of the shooter, who I'm sure you've seen that we've reported knew about his plan in advance and maybe even went to the club with him at some time before for some kind of reconnaissance, the way one person described it to us. But they said no charges now. And of course, they could be being coy. In fact, they are being coy. But really walked back the idea that they were certain that anyone was going to be charged in this case. But other than that, nothing really jumped out as like a new big breaking piece of information that they released today.
What information do you really want to explore, and what questions do you have that ultimately will be answered, but the sooner the better as far as you're concerned?
Well, I think certainly knowing if anyone is going to be charged is the big one. I mean, the shooter is obviously deceased, and you want to know about his motivation and his exact timeline leading up to this, but also want to know, and I think probably the public wants to know, if there are others who might have some responsibility in this attack, and if the American justice system needs to move to hold those people accountable. And then I think the second thing I kind of touched on is that what exactly led up to this? You know, what was he doing in the weeks before this attack as far as planning? What exactly did he do inside that club during the 3 hours or so he was in there? What is the exact TikTok? That takes a lot of time to sort out. I don't know that we're going to get that answered in a day, but I'd be very curious to know what they come up with.
And as you have reported, the Post has reported, he was in that club on previous occasions as well, many months before this attack. So what was he doing in the club at that time? Do you know, you reported that he had called during the standoff, he had called an acquaintance somewhere in Florida. Is there any more on that story, who he called?
Yeah, I wish I could tell you more on that story, and that's certainly something we understand they're looking at, too. I just don't have a lot of detail there, you know, what they talked about, if they talked about anything. I did talk to one gentleman today who claimed to be in the bathroom with him when he was calling 911, and he made some comment that this guy claimed about ISIS, but no seeming no, nothing he heard seemed to be a phone call to somebody elsewhere in Florida.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that there has been a lot of attention paid to, and now it's resulting in a filibuster, as you know, on the Senate floor, with Democrats calling for some kind of gun action and agreement, it would appear, between Republicans and Democrats that terrorists, potential terrorists, should not have access to guns. A lot's been discussed with this 10-month investigation of him that ended in 2014, where he was placed on a terrorism watch list, and the FBI coming under some criticism for having done other investigations and people have conducted acts of terror after they have been investigated. What did the FBI respond to that at all, how you could let somebody go after they had been investigated for such a long period of time?
Yeah, the FBI, today they addressed that a little bit at the briefing at the assistant special agent charge down in Tampa, but overseeing the Orlando office. He said, look, that they have legal and ethical restrictions when it comes to investigations. And I think what he means by that is, you know, the FBI can investigate someone, but if they want to restrict their liberty in any way, they need some sort of evidence that would give them the ability to do that. They would, frankly, would need to charge them with a crime. I mean, I know there's been a talk a lot about the terror watch list, and this guy was on it, a list called the Select Key List, but then taken off. I mean, there's a lot of lawsuits over the no-fly list itself, and some of them have been successful because it's kind of this thing where the people placed on it don't have due process, can't really challenge their status, at least that's what these lawsuits allege. So yeah, I guess it's just a more complicated issue than, well, you're on the terrorist watch list, so you can't buy a gun, because that's a lot of liberty being restricted without a lot of due process.
Mm-hmm. So did the FBI have an answer to this of how you can better track somebody who may be on a watch list and may be fully capable of carrying out the kind of terror that he did last weekend?
Yeah, in this specific case, I guess I should have made this clear, they've generally defended, but you're right that in this specific case, there are a lot of things you can question, right? So this guy, they had for a while listened in on some of his phone calls, interviewed him. That seems pretty serious, and you would almost hope there would be a mechanism in place where maybe they can't put him on a watch list that automatically triggers liberty restrictions, but just monitor him in other ways. And they haven't really thoroughly addressed that.
There were statements today at the press conference that there have been threats to members of the Muslim community in Florida. Do you know anything about that?
They didn't offer any specifics on that. I saw some local news reports about, I think, a building being defaced, if I remember correctly. I also talked to an activist down here who, not from this area, but had heard of a sign being defaced at a mosque elsewhere in the country. I think it might have been Wisconsin. So, I mean, when these things happen, very unfortunately, people can respond hatefully. The FBI at this press conference today sort of reminded people that, look, those are civil rights crimes. Threats like that against protected persons, against religious groups, are civil rights crimes, and they're gonna prosecute you if you do that sort of stuff. Federal civil rights crimes are no joke.
Mm-hmm. Going back to his wife, where is she now?
That's a good question. She's been, I think the last time she was spotted, and I have some of my colleagues down there, so maybe they've seen her more recently than this, but I think the last time she was spotted was going into the home she once shared with the shooter, and her father-in-law said she was getting clothes or something. But other than that, she's been, I don't know where she's been, kind of in seclusion. I'm sure she has relatives or friends or somebody else that media wouldn't be able to stake out.
And in terms of what you're seeing on the street in Orlando, there just must be this incredibly enormous sadness with families coming in and having to deal with the death and this horror. What are you seeing on the streets in terms of vigils, in terms of families grieving?
Yeah, I've been to two vigils myself, one very large one, thousands of people. Mm. It wasn't yesterday, but the day before, in front of the Dr. Phillips Center. There's some pretty iconic images circulating around the Internet from that, and just so sad. I mean, that community, those people, feel very much attacked. There's certainly resilience, but, you know, it was just a horror show inside that club, talking to people who were there, talking to people who lost loved ones. There's immense sadness. I don't know another way to put it.
And how long do you think it will take? Do you have any sense of the investigation, how long it will take, Matt, for us to have more answers as to what motivated him?
Yeah, that is a great question. And at the briefing recently, somebody asked that in multiple different ways, and they just sort of kept repeating they can't put a timeline on it. I mean, look, it's going to take a long, long time. You think about 50 people being killed, another 50-plus being wounded, a three-hour encounter. Even the encounter itself, to fully reconstruct that, to map the path of all those bullets, that's going to take a while. And then you've got to go back in this shooter's life, not just in the what did he do the day before, but I think they're trying to go back months, if not longer. They said right. They're going back months to see what, you know, where this guy was set off, if one particular thing set him off, how he developed the way he did. I mean, I don't think this is something where by the end of the week we're going to have all the answers. I don't know if it's something by the end of the year that we'll have all the answers.
Mm-hmm. And what about those who are wounded? Have any more been released from the hospital? Is there any word on condition today?
You know, truth be told, I haven't been at the hospital. I know that the hospital put out recently that all of those there had stabilized, and to me, I read that as there didn't seem to be a risk for further death. But I wouldn't want to give you sort of hard numbers on more people being released. I assume they're probably methodically working to discharge people, but I just haven't been over at the hospital today, so I wouldn't want to speak on that.
There are just so many angles to this story, Matt, aren't there, and reaction to this story, too. The terrorist, is he claiming allegiance to ISIS? Was there foreign involvement? Was he gay? Was it because of his religious belief he couldn't stand the fact that he was gay, or his family would not have accepted him, so maybe he committed this act against others because of homophobia? I mean, there are so many different angles here, and people seem to latch on to whatever belief it is they want to have, political examination and explanation for this, but there are many levels to this story, aren't there?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I think somebody said at a vigil yesterday, or maybe it was at a press conference, that they're really trying to make sense of something that is really inherently senseless.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the shooting of 50 people
exactly.
in a nightclub is senseless.
Right.
You know, there are just so many ways you can go, so many leads to track down. Reporters are trying to do that. Law enforcement is trying to do that. It's really a sprawling kind of investigation.
Yeah. What will you be working on today, Matt, or have already worked on?
Well, I'll be trying to find out more about what's going on with that investigation. I don't think there are any more briefings scheduled today, but I and my colleagues will be working contacts in the law enforcement world. And we're doing a lot of the same things investigators are doing. I mean, trying to talk to people who are inside that club and can give us firsthand accounts, trying to track down family members of victims to tell us about the real human loss of life here. So, you know, we're doing all of those things. I'm doing all of those things.
Yeah. Matt, thank you very much for spending time with us.
Of course. Thank you.
Must be a very, very hard story to cover. Matt Zapatosky is a reporter. He's at the Washington Post, where he covers the Justice Department. The Post has been doing, of course, extensive reporting on the mass shooting, and Matt has been there all week. As we continue, Lillian Faderman will join us. Lillian is an internationally known scholar of lesbian history and literature, as well as ethnic history. She's the author of several books. Her latest is The Gay Revolution, The Story of the Struggle. And she will be with us to talk about the importance of LGBT bars and, ironically, as a place to be a safe haven, but they also have been targets of deadly attacks. Nothing as large as what was experienced last week, but there have been many other attacks. We'll be welcoming phone calls. If you'd like to join our conversation, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We welcome your comments there as well. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Lillian Faderman is with us, historian, author of many books, including The Gay Revolution, The Story of the Struggle. And thank you, Lillian, so much for being with us. Hi.
Thank you for having me. I'm just sorry. It's such a sad occasion.
What a sad occasion. What an incredibly, it just hurts your soul, doesn't it?
And real tragedy.
Yeah, a real tragedy. And it's not the only tragedy. What's interesting, there's so many levels to this story, as we were talking about the first half hour here, but there have been other tragedies, other attacks on LGBT safe haven gathering places in the past, which we haven't known very much about. So some things have changed. It took an enormous tragedy, and it's now nonstop news, certainly. But not that long ago, we didn't pay much attention to other attacks, did we?
The worst attack until the present one was in 1973 in New Orleans in a bar called the Upstairs, when an arsonist set fire to the bar, and 32 people were killed and many were injured. What was so different about that 1973 attack and the tragedy of that and what's happened today is that when the Times-Picayune, the New Orleans newspaper, talked about the arson at the Upstairs bar, they didn't mention in the beginning that it was a gay club. Incidentally, I should say that the preferred term for all of us in 1973 was not LGBT, but gay, mm-hmm. and that included lesbians and transgender people and bisexual people as well. But the Times-Picayune didn't mention it was a gay club. There is a record of families not even wanting to claim the bodies of those who were killed because they discovered they were killed in a gay club. There were funeral services in which the preachers refused to mention that the victims, the dead, were gay. This is so different, and I think the LGBT community has reason to feel so supported by the wider community, by so much of America now.
Yes.
At least that's one heartening thing to come out of this terrible tragedy.
Lillian, is it important for us to understand why he targeted an LGBT club?
Well, the importance is that that homophobia is rife in religious extremist groups,
mm-hmm.
of course, in among radical Islams, but it's also rife among radical Christians, the Christian right. I don't think the Christian right, for the most part, would go as far as what Omar Mateen did, but their rhetoric has been hateful and very dangerous to the LGBT community.
And also, is there, somebody wrote a piece that I read today asking the question, what if he was gay?
Doesn't matter. If he was gay, it's just one more indication that religious extremism has poisoned, in this case, a gay person so much that he could be murderous. He could willingly kill 49 people and injure over 50 others because he hated himself, and he hated himself so much because of the line about gay people that he's learned from religious extremism.
Tell me, I know many people have been totally understandably completely unnerved by this. You've seen these demonstrations and these gatherings in cities all over the country.
And all over the world.
And the world as well. To have a place that, I mean, places have been attacked before, but to have a place where you can be yourself and dance and have a good time and feel some sense of being safe because people accept who you are. I would think that a lot of people in the community feel pretty shattered, that safety feels shattered right now.
I think so, but I think also there is a determination that this has pulled us together even more, that we're determined to fight homophobia wherever it appears. I think that we are indeed shattered, but I think that what will come out of it is just more strength and more strength to insist that we are first-class American citizens and that the laws have to reflect that. I think it's time, for instance, for the government to recognize that LGBT people need to be added to the 1964 Civil Rights Act, along with the other groups that are protected through that act, such as religious and racial minorities.
Mm-hmm. You have been quoted. I was reading some of your thoughts on all of this, on the history. You have said, I think the hatred on the part of the religious right was rife then, back in the 70s, and grew throughout the 1970s as gay people were getting more and more rights. Frank Bruni wrote an interesting column, I'm sure you saw today, in which he was critical of Roman Catholic leaders and other religious leaders who had not expressed solidarity with members of the LGBT community. He quotes the Reverend James Martin, a best-selling Jesuit author: "If the murders had happened, God forbid, in a church of a particular Christian denomination, Catholic leaders would decry the murders and then naturally express their solidarity with members of that denomination," he said in a video. And then Martin also said there were exceptions. I think this is interesting, from Bishop Robert Lynch of St. Petersburg, who wrote a blog saying that religion, including Catholicism, often breeds contempt for gays, lesbians, and transgender people, and this contempt can lead to violence. So what's to be done about that? I would assume that you would agree with that. What's to be done about that?
Absolutely. I think the churches have to begin to recognize that their homophobic position is dangerous to human beings. It's not, in this case, the church that has ignited Omar Mateen, but it's true of all extremist religions. It's true of the religious right, whether it's Muslim or whether it's Christian. I'm hoping that the terrible tragedy of this will make some religious groups come to their senses and recognize that their rhetoric is what ignites this kind of hatred that Omar Mateen had in so willingly killing 50 people, 49 people, and injuring 53 other people. I think that people within those various denominations that have been so rejecting of LGBT people, Southern Baptists, for instance, and Mormons, I think congregants need to press the hierarchy in those denominations to change their view, to change their policy on LGBT people.
What is remarkable, and maybe we're all, not all of us, but you want to believe that we have come so far on this issue, young people in particular, but the country has, not in all areas, but certainly you can just see the expression of solidarity and the amount of coverage this horrendous attack has received. But not everybody's there yet, right? I mean,
not everybody is there. Some politicians expressed sympathy for the families of those who were killed, but still haven't uttered the term LGBT.
Right.
It's not enough to express sympathy to the families. They need to recognize that the victims in this case were LGBT and that it's widespread homophobia among the religious right, whether it's Islams or Christians, that contribute to this kind of violence.
We're welcoming phone calls. Lillian Faderman is our guest. She is a historian. She's the author of many books, including most recently The Gay Revolution, The Story of the Struggle. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. We start with Randy in Eau Claire. Hi, Randy.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead, Randy.
Yes,
Randy, you'll have to turn the radio down. We'll go back to you. You can't hear what you're saying. Jerry in La Crosse, hi.
Hello, yes, thank you. I'm interested in learning about the very root reason for the prejudice against gay people. And I'd like to suggest that I heard something once that seems logical, and I wonder if this is true, that back when the Bible was written, the science was not very good, and that they believed at that time that sperm actually was the baby, and that therefore, you know, wasting this or killing this was against their religion. And that, based upon that fallacious idea, has built this prejudice that lasts in both Abrahamic religions, both Muslim and Christian, until now. Can you help me with that?
Well, I'm not a biblical scholar, but let me say that the Bible was written over a huge period of time, but by an endangered tribe, and procreation was very important because the tribe was endangered, and as it was seen, homosexuality, not a term at that time, of course, but sodomy, did not contribute to procreation. So it would make sense that that endangered tribe would be concerned about spilling the seed, wasting sperm instead of procreating.
Thanks for your call. Dan is next in Bloomer. Dan, hello.
I was just calling to see what your thoughts were on this attack being a backlash from all of the transgender bathroom legislation.
I think that certainly the transgender bathroom legislation has been in the news a lot, and I think it's probably contributed to the atmosphere that made Omar Mateen choose a gay club rather than Disney World, as he was thinking of for a while, or attacking a synagogue or whatever. I'm sure it was on his mind. The LGBT community was on his mind because there's been so much coverage of the transgender issue. But I would guess, too, that even without the transgender bathroom issue, he has been filled with so much hatred of LGBT people. We see in countries where ISIS has taken over, in Iraq, for instance, gay men have been thrown from rooftops in public executions that look very much like medieval times. So while I think the transgender bathroom issue and all of the coverage that it's had recently might have been a contributing factor by itself, that certainly would not have been enough to set Omar Mateen off.
Well, in an article I was reading this morning, more than 200 anti-LGBT bills have been introduced in 34 states.
Yes, yes, right. Right, so despite the fact that I think those of us who are LGBT can't deny that we have allies, that we have so many friends out there, that people realize now that we're your sons and your daughters and your brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles and good friends and neighbors, as they didn't realize before. There are still these pockets of hatred towards us that contribute to of violence. I was going to say occasional violence, and it has been occasional. Many of the people who have been victims have been transgender people in more recent years. But this present violence, of course, is mind-boggling, worse than has ever happened before.
Yeah, it is mind-boggling. Randy in Eau Claire, hi. Randy, are you there? Well, I don't know where Randy is. Luba in Madison. Hi.
Hi there. I have a question. Now, I read the New York Times, and when I read, I think it was the first article, they mentioned that he has a three-year-old child or someone under five.
Mm-hmm.
And he noticed kissing and touching. Now, the paper didn't explain just exactly what touching meant, but you can go through a wide range. Was this done on the street? I'm sure he's not going to take that child into the club. And I feel that if it's in the street, I mean, that's... I really disapprove of that sort of thing. I'm sorry. And then another
you
thing
disapprove
is...
disapprove of straight couples kissing on the street, too?
I wish you would, as SWT, it tries to be as factual as possible, don't guess and say, well, maybe he's homosexual, maybe he's this, maybe he's don't. Stick to the facts. That's all I want. And I think that's all the listeners want. But don't go into what, you know, what if he's, because that's not, that's speculation, and how should I put it, it tells you nothing.
Well, he was doing dating sites. Obviously, the press is going to look at that issue. He was going to gay dating sites. He was at this club more than just on the weekend. I mean, you have to throw that element in here, too, because it's a part of a very complicated story. I didn't hear what she said at the beginning. Did you hear what she said? I didn't get the thrust of the comment because I couldn't quite hear it.
I think the caller said that she disapproved of gay men kissing on the street, and my question was whether she would disapprove of heterosexuals engaging in similar behavior. Perhaps she does. Perhaps she doesn't like any kind of public display of affection. But my point is that I think that just as heterosexuals walk with their arms around one another's waist or peck each other on the cheek on the street or whatever, it's not inappropriate for gay people to do the same. On the other hand, if there was groping or whatever, that would be different, but we wouldn't want heterosexuals groping on the street either. And I don't know what it is that Mateen saw with his 3-year-old son. But whatever he saw is obviously no excuse for killing 49 people.
Let's go to Abraham in Green Bay. Hi, Abraham.
Hi, Kathleen. I'm a UW Green Bay student, and I'm a student of Muslim heritage. And, you know, I would like to say that I've been hearing a lot in the liberal media in this country that, you know, let's not, you know, marginalize Muslims and so on. And they're absolutely right on that. But what we need to address is a abundance of hatred for LGBT peoples in the Muslim community here in this country. And I think it needs to be addressed from within rather than from without. But now, either way, it has to be addressed. And, you know, I can actually name the people who, in this case, sympathize with the shooter simply because they dislike or quite hate LGBT peoples. And I would like to say that the issue is not really, you know, the religion or the people or, you know, them not being, these people not being familiar with Western culture and values, but rather simply a lack of education. I would guesstimate that around 98%, if not even more, of the educated Muslim people in this country and for the much of the West support gay rights. They you know, there were a whole group of people out protesting in Orlando, and there was a group out praying for gay people. And you know, what we need to do is educate, you know, invest in education in minority groups and especially in the Muslim community here and also elsewhere. But again, we can't even provide education to the very own, to our very own. We can't even provide education to, you know, the most American. Forget about the immigrants that are first generation or second generation or third generation.
Thank you, Abraham, for your call. Go ahead, Lillian, with your response.
I think it's true that LGBT Muslims should be educating the Muslim community, and I think that many of them are trying to. I think the problem is that the group of LGBT Muslims who are out and trying to educate the community is very small. And the reason it's small is that they feel the homophobia within the community, and they feared to come out themselves. They feared to come out to their families and to their close friends and fellow congregants because they fear rejection. So I think it's not only the job of other Muslims, to gay Muslims, to educate the community, but all of us need to be doing that. All of us need to help in educating the Muslim community.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of hate going around on many fronts, isn't there?
Yes, right, right, yes. Yes, and so much of it has to do not with simply Muslims or simply Christians, but religious extremism.
Thanks, Abraham, for your call. Jack in Kenosha, hi.
Yes, a friend of mine referred me to a site after the tragedy. It's called Joe by God, and I couldn't believe what I saw on it. There was a video of a Latino Baptist minister celebrating the 50 pedophiles, as he called it, had been killed, and now the streets of Orlando were safer, and was calling for gay people to be lined up against the wall and their brains blown out. If we don't think that in some parts of the country and in some religious groups, this kind of extremism is there, you can see it. Yeah. My response is twofold, and I'd like the guest's comment on this. One, I think instead of saying that this stuff is terrible and owning our own values, we really have to begin to stand up in every way we can against homophobia, misogyny, racism. When somebody says something that demeans another human being, we should call it and say, I don't want to hear that. It demeans people. It's wrong. We should be calling our politicians, all of them, and anyone who allows us. There were two Republican candidates who went to a conference where there was, again, a minister who was calling for gays to be killed. If they stayed at that conference, why aren't they called on it? We need to call people and hold people accountable for what they say, what they do, and their allegiance.
Thanks, Jack, for your call. Yes. Lillian?
And I think that's an excellent point, and I think that's happening. What is so wonderful now is opposed to 1973, when 32 people were killed in a gay bar in New Orleans, is the media is so much on our side now, and we have our own media. We have the internet, and I think we are calling people out for their homophobic comments, we need to continue to do that. But you know, if polls can be believed, I really feel that most of America has been on our side, even before this tragedy. And I think this tragedy has made other people who couldn't express their support for us in the past, has made them speak up. I was astonished, for instance, to hear Paul Ryan give his condolences, finally, he said it, to the LGBT community. And Mitt Romney finally said it, that his sympathies were with the LGBT community. These people haven't been our friends in the past, but perhaps a tragedy like this has made them understand that homophobia is dangerous and has turned them around.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Michael next in Danbury. Hi, Michael.
Hi, and thank you for listening. As I spoke to your interviewer there, I think this is a really a big movement of humanity having to step back and recognize that the critical ingredient that has created this life that we experience in all of its kind is diversity. And that each community, plant, animal, person, gay, straight, whatever, is essential for life to prosper on this planet. And we need to get there in our thinking. It's called acceptance, not agreement.
I Yeah, we seem to have a, I agree with you. We seem to have a hard time with that, even though that's what we are, Lily, and that's what this country is.
Yes, I think there have been periods when we've had a much harder time with that as a historian. I think back to the 1950s when there was no support for LGBT people or gay people, as we were all called in, no support for gay people anywhere. Certainly no politician would have come out to support us. There would certainly have been no laws that favored us. We were witch hunted out of the military. Now LGBT people can serve openly in the military. It was absolutely unthinkable in other eras that we could get married legally. Now, of course, in every state we can get married legally, at least according to the law, although there are some states that tried to throw up barriers to that. So I think that we're moving in the right direction. The arc of justice is bending in the right way, and I think we have reason to be heartened by that. And that makes us all the more shocked when something happens
right,
like what just happened in Orlando. It just seems we've been on the road to such progress for the last years, and then this takes us aback.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a lot of other kinds of forces in the world today, too. It's hard to make sense of all of it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Our guest this hour is Lillian Faderman. She's an internationally known scholar of lesbian history and literature, as well as ethnic history and literature. She's the author of a number of books, including the latest, The Gay Revolution, The Story of the Struggle. Our phone number, we have one line open, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we are talking about the emotional response, the attack on the LGBT community in Orlando, the response when you feel that so much progress has been made and then to have this happen. And we're talking about that this hour. And welcoming your phone calls, 800-486-8655. What's to be done about hate? Lillian Faderman is our guest, and we go back to phone calls to Tom in Mineral Point. Hi, Tom.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm married, identify as being human, and I'm Roman Catholic. At Mass Saturday night, before all this happened, our pastor emeritus was given a homily, and then he added on that in his 50 years of counsel that, he had encountered a lot of gays, and that it was his opinion that they were born that way, children of God, and entitled to all rights, privileges, and love. He got a huge round of applause. I happen to know that not all the people sitting there that day felt that way. I can't speak for the church. I don't speak for the clergy, but I will speak for the faith. So just want you to know there's a lot of loving Christians out there that don't espouse any of this. And one other thing, you keep referring to it as a tragedy. It's not a tragedy. It was an atrocity.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's a good correction. Thank you. Yes.
Thanks, Tom. And what Tom says, I know there are a lot of people of a lot of different faiths, you know, Muslims and Catholics and people who do not agree that hatred is acceptable. Hatred of LGBT, not acceptable. Hatred of other religions. And yes, and yet when you look at what policies are in churches, do you have the full rights as everybody else? You know, as straight people, if you're in the Muslim faith, in the Catholic faith, etc. Women, for that matter, in the Catholic Church as well. It's not completely open to everybody.
I think that the churches are really coming around. There are so many denominations of Protestantism.
Yes.
In recent years have expressed support for LGBT people. Judaism has certainly expressed support for LGBT people, beginning with Reform Judaism and then Conservative Judaism, and more recently many Orthodox Jews have officially expressed support, although we're not totally there yet in terms of complete support from the Orthodox community, but there are pockets of religious extremists that really intensify whatever hate there is out there, and that has to be tackled. And I like the notion that one of your callers suggested, that it needs to be tackled within, that gay and lesbian Muslims need to tackle the Muslim community. I think it's true of LGBT Mormons, and they have been doing that. They have been working on other Mormons, and I think the Mormon Church is lightening its policies against LGBT people. I know that there are people who are Southern Baptists and LGBT who have been working on Southern Baptists, but there's still a long way to go. Mm-hmm. I think religious extremists are the main enemy of LGBT people, and I think that we need to find ways to reach those religious extremists.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about security, safety, safe havens for a moment before we go back to phone calls. I have heard a lot of people say that they're afraid, and I understand that fully. What is it that clubs, LGBT clubs, can do to restore a sense of security? Does that just take time, or do they need extra security in place so that safe havens will again feel like safe havens?
I think at this point in time, LGBT clubs will have extra security, but I was so heartened to hear that the Los Angeles Gay Pride Parade went on as scheduled, despite the fact that some perpetrator
yes.
was caught with a car full of explosives ready to create mayhem at the parade. I think that if we stop doing what we've been doing, then we've lost. And I don't think the LGBT community will stop. I think we realize that we have to live our lives, that we can't change what we do. Of course, extra security will be needed, but I think we need to keep moving ahead as we've been moving ahead. And the progress that we've made by not stopping has been truly phenomenal.
It has been phenomenal. Eric in Verona, hi.
Hi. My comment would try to go to the motive behind this gentleman. Gentleman's probably the wrong word, but why he did what he did. My thinking is that he's obviously, with the dating app and the time that he spent in the club already, that if he's homosexual and he's a Muslim, and if he believes that it's such a sin and that it makes you less of a person, I wonder if he's not just a self-loathing individual who's done what he's done to try to atone for his own perception of it, of the twisted perception that he's got about how life should be.
Yeah, and then you mix in some kind of allegiance to an Islamic state and you can do an act of horror. I don't know. I guess we're just fascinated by that because we're human beings and he just did this act of total terror.
You know, if he had homosexual ideas, it's sort of irrelevant except that his extremist religion convinced him that such ideas
right. Yeah.
were terrible and needed to be exorcised
mm-hmm.
somehow. His extremist religion created self-hatred in him if he indeed did have homosexual ideas. But we certainly, as an LGBT community, could never claim him as one of ours.
No.
Had homosexual ideas. Those were ideas that he wanted to kill in himself and kill
yeah.
49 other people along with himself, feeling as he felt, if indeed that was true. We don't know yet if that
yeah.
was.
Lillian, thank you very much. It's just a haunting story. It's such a hard one. Golly, it's a hard one. Thank you for being with us.
Yeah. Thank you for asking me. I'm just sorry this atrocity was the occasion.
No, I am too. Lillian Faderman, she is a scholar of lesbian history and literature, author most recently of The Gay Revolution, The Story of the Struggle. Thanks to Chris Molina for producing this hour, and to Chris as well for his on-air production work here in Milwaukee. Thanks for listening. We're with you again tomorrow. News is coming up, and lots more interesting talk.